Okay, so this is supposed to be an informal discussion about gauge string duality and applications to strongly coupled plasma dynamics. And I was planning on doing most of this just on the blackboard, but showing some pictures projected at the end, which are just nice pictures. The challenge of the audience here. So, obviously some people need no introduction to what is gauge string duality all about. But are there some people who think I should spend a little time on the basic framework and where this came from?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, well, so I'll try. Okay, so actually before I get into that, I do want to say a little bit about motivation and even the experimental setting, because it's stuff I want you all to be thinking about, and I will hopefully come back a little bit in the end. So everything I'm going to talk about is basically motivated by efforts to understand what we see in heavy ion collisions, and without spending a lot of time on the phenomenology, which is a whole talk in itself, I just want to mention a few things. If you look at the modeling of heavy ion collisions at RIC, if you say, what is the earliest point in that collision at which it makes sense to start talking about some sort of thermal description, you're at least approximately thermalized, you can introduce some notion of a temperature, it's the highest temperature that the system will have, because after that point it just expands, cools. If you say, what is that maximum temperature that you're probing, it's something in the neighborhood of about 300-ish MeV, which is roughly twice the deconfinement temperature in QCD, which we know from lattice studies, it's a sharp crossover, I'll just call it the deconfinement transition. If you want to look to the future and say, what's going to happen at LHC, it's going to be doing collisions at substantially higher energy, but the actual size of the blob of plasma you're making is about the same. If you recall the relation between energy density and temperature, well, energy density goes like temperature to the fourth. If you want to turn it around, there's a root of fourth root. And the net result is the highest temperatures we're likely to be probing at LHC are only in the neighborhood of about 800 MeV, which is just a little bit over 4 times Tc. So that's what we're studying experimentally. QCD in this temperature range. Yeah? It's a very small perturbation. Forget about it. Okay, what do we know? I just want to put a few things up that we know from lattice studies that are relevant in this range. I guess I'll stick it over here. So one of these things has sort of been widely discussed. We just know the equation of state. If you present that as simply what is the pressure divided by the ideal gas pressure, or the Stefan-Boltzmann limit, in the limit of infinite temperature, asymptotic freedom says this ratio would be 1. In this temperature range, to quite a good approximation, it's constant and roughly 0.8. And whether that means it's close to being weakly coupled or, in fact, is strongly coupled is an issue that's generated lots of confusion. I want to mention two other observables, which are actually more interesting. In this thermoplasma, you can measure screening lengths, correlation lengths. You can measure screening lengths in any symmetry channel you want. So there's really a whole list of screening lengths that you can think about, that you can extract from lattice simulations. Simulations by Datta and Gupta just a handful of years ago tell us that this is with fermions. So MD is the Debye mass. That's simply a name for the screening length in a particular symmetry channel. And so this is the inverse of the screening length, the screening mass. And as I just wrote there, it's about 6. If you say what is the longest screening length or what is the smallest inverse screening length, that's the mass gap, it's about 3. And if you make a picture of these masses over temperature as a function of T over TC, where here's 1, here's 2, here's 3, here's 4, and so on, basically, there's interesting structure very close to TC. But if you look at that temperature range, pretty much the screening masses are constant. And as I wrote here, they are not small compared to 1. If this was a weakly coupled plasma, screening lengths would be large compared to the basic inner particle spacing. That's the same thing as saying these ratios would be small compared to 1. They're not. So this evidence,
3 is G squared, right?
At asymptotically high temperature, this one... Yeah, at asymptotically high temperature, this would scale like G squared and become small, and this one would scale like G.
3 is G squared. G is square root of 3. G squared of 4 pi is so small.
But let me phrase it this way, though. If you really say, what are corrections to your weak coupling approximation? You can talk about alphas and pis, but what really comes in are precisely these ratios. So that's really a more, for thermal corrections, that's a more direct way.
The thermals are the corrections that the M gap around are more.
Sorry?
One thing which I said in my talk, that this is the metric mass of G, it can be personalization and it actually goes to something that is zero. But if we plot magnetic mass, which is the chromosome in G squared G, and it is like this, and it actually writes to something. And in that region, that equals, and then different powers of G. So it's clear it's like the chromosome.
So I just want you to appreciate that there's this window, which happens to be the experimentally accessible temperature range, where, at least according to these ratios, it looks like things are strongly coupled. That is, it's not a weakly coupled perturbative system. There's no interesting temperature dependence. In fact, these ratios being constant is exactly what you'd have to have in any conformal theory, where there's no other scale other than T. And at least from this graph, it looks pretty good. Asymptopia is way, way out there, where weak coupling methods are clearly...
What are the error, how big are the error bars?
Oh, I can show you an actual plot later, but these are pretty well established. We're not talking about error bars, which you should worry about. Yeah.
But if you plot the energy density of a certain boson result, you get something that's flat. But I thought for the pressure...
The pressure is not quite so flat.
Temperature dependent.
Yeah, but again...
I'm just saying...
At the 10-15% level, you're absolutely right.
Unfortunately, we don't spend it on the distribution. The experiment that starts at this temperature spend about one third of the time.
Absolutely. So as the system cools, you clearly pass through a region where lambda QCD becomes a relevant scale, the physics is more complicated, of course you hadronize, all kinds of complicated stuff happens, but this at least says there's a window. And the one point I want to make is, it's not like this is going to be a dramatically different discussion at LHC. Okay, so what do? We'd like to understand QCD in this region, and it's too hard. Although we can do lattice simulations for equilibrium quantities, if you ask about real-time dependent situations, basically we have no good approximation techniques. So what do? Instead? We do the classic theorist approach of switch and bait. Bait and switch, you know what I mean? We change the theory. So I'll describe this as doing three different deformations of QCD. First, instead of thinking about three colors, I want to send it to infinity. Of all the changes I'm going to make, this is surely the most innocuous. Essentially, all the physics I'm going to be concerned with today, we know has finite limits as the number of colors goes to infinity. That includes screening lengths, that includes transport coefficients, that includes things like the photon emission spectrum, heavy quark energy loss rates. So I'm basically going to ask you to trust that this is the least of our problems. All right. I'm going to change the matter fields. If we were discussing zero temperature particle spectrum, this would be a horrible thing to do. I mean, what you see in the particle data book is totally dependent on the fact that quarks are in the fundamental representation. But the physics I'm going to be talking about is really the physics of a plasma. A plasma is just a bunch of charges running around. And it's really not a big deal whether those charges happen to be in the fundamental representation or the adjoint representation. All right, so for technical reasons, we're going to replace the fundamental representation quarks with adjoint representation fermions and scalars.
How do you know that it's an accurate
plasma? For a whole list of qualitative questions, I could try and argue that to you at a qualitative level. If you will, let me come back to that toward the end of this discussion where we can at least say a few things about it at least a semi-quantitative level and say how much, what do we know about sensitivity to this change?
For posteriori reasons, but a priori.
Well, a priori, you can argue that they're both non-abelian plasmas. That means they don't confine. They have Debye screening. The spatial, large spatial Wilson loops work just the same way. Basically show area law behavior. So, you know, a whole list of qualities. Oh, the most importantly, the one I should mention is you can argue from first principles that the long wavelength, low frequency, non-equilibrium response of the system is described by neutral fluid hydrodynamics and nothing else. That's equally true for real QCD as for this deform theory. Great. Right. And that's my third change. Having sent the number of colors to infinity, the appropriate measure of the interaction strength is, of course, the Etouffe coupling, G squared N. If I change my matter fields in just the right way, the result will be a theory, namely maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, where the coupling doesn't run, it's just a number, you get to pick it, whatever you want. And we're going to study this theory when that number is large. Uh-huh.
Isn't this actually even against your second point that changing the matter field is an abuse? Because if you don't change them, you can get something that's strongly coupled all the way up to the UV, and that has a good superior description. But if you stay in QCD, you don't have that. And that's a crucial difference.
Yes, but So everything you just said is true, but the physics that you referred to is physics that's happening at very short distance. All of the physics I want you to be thinking about today is really physics that's probing the response of a plasma on, at least in principle, experimentally accessible scales. So basically what's relevant is physics on the scale of the temperature, physics on the scale of these screening lengths. So although it's true that changing the matter content changes the way the coupling runs at very short distance, it's just not relevant, right? Imagine integrating out all those short distance degrees of freedom and we're working from scales of the temperature on down.
Remind me of what the
Well, there's a very, very short list where 1 over lambda corrections are known. For shear viscosity, I don't have that number right at my fingertips, but I think it's in the neighborhood of 6 or 10 is when the subleading correction becomes 50% or comparable to the leading. But I want to emphasize, we really don't know subleading corrections for an interestingly long list of quantities, and it's quite possible that they'll be different.
You say that in real QCD, lambda is of order.
Edward's arguing that in real QCD, as applied to heavy ion physics, that the appropriate lambda to use is going to be closer to 20.
And also, that means in real QCD, there is some definition of lambda, A lambda.
At some scale. And then the issue is what's the most relevant scale for the physics you're probing?
You're saying the real lambda is of order 20 or something?
Look, can I suggest we come back to this at the end? I mean, scheme dependence.
First of all, lambda is alpha n times 4 pi times n, which is already 4 pi times 3, and that's the
g-squared of order 3, then you get about 10 of them.
Where it comes from potentials. For example, the simplest quantity is potential between
two. No, but just repeat what you said, because I think you said it backwards, right? If alpha s is a half, right, then lambda is
a half to get 20, but I'm not sure why alpha s.
With regards to those distances, if you look at Coulomb force, you can just like the charges on the lattice, the factor is the output of the calculus.
That's much.
But the main argument is not this, guys. This is all up to the fact. The main argument is kind of works. That's the argument. Yes?
Let's come back to this.
Oh, I don't think it works.
No, it is in
high. Right. It is true that if you take perturbative calculations and attempt to compare with data, you find that you have to crank up alpha to somewhere in this neighborhood to even be in the ballpark. Okay.
Somehow they send it. I guess an assumption here that you say that the behavior from this 1.5 TC upwards is from physically different origin than below it. I mean, when confinement, deconfinement, or confining transition kicks in, the curve comes down.
I'm saying that's simply what lattice studies have shown.
Sure, I mean, no question about that. But I mean, you make kind of difference. I mean, you say that the these two domains have the behavior comes from physically different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, when you calculate the pressure, say, in perturbation theory, Well, we know that it's all over the place, of course, at this temperature range.
Mm-hmm.
But when you fix, let's say, the missing knowledge there by fixing some constants arbitrarily, only fitting to the data, then it can describe this curve to extremely good accuracy. And there, definitely, there's only one physics behind it. There's not kind of special domain of different kind of physics in different kind of temperature.
I truly don't think you're saying anything that contradicts with what I said. I mean, yes, you're right. You're describing in one framework a much wider range of temperature. But what you put into it was information about what was the relevant mass scale, basically how these screening masses are behaving.
Sure.
And there's no contradiction with saying you had one formula. What was important in that formula can depend on what temperature you're looking at. And certainly there's a temperature range where the physics of those non-zero screening masses is a big effect.
Mm-hmm.
Quite possible there's a range where it's a much smaller effect. Right? But I was hoping to just put this discussion now, to put it up, two questions. One of which just says, grant me the freedom to make these deformations, and it's then simply an interesting question to say, what do we understand about the non-equilibrium dynamics of this theory that's no longer QCD, but at least it's just a few steps removed from QCD. All right, so... And this is an interesting question simply because this theory is now easier to study than QCD. Certainly there's a second question, which I think some of these comments speak to, which is this deform theory a good model for real QCD? And time permitting, which it may not, I was hoping to say a little bit about both of those. Okay, that was all the 2-minute warm-up. So I think I'm really not going to say much of anything about gauge string duality, which is also called ADS-CFT duality, but that's really sort of a trade name that's kind of misleading because the interesting applications are not necessarily to conformal field theories and don't necessarily involve ADS space. But we have compelling reason to believe that this particular field theory is identical to a particular string theory on a particular 10-dimensional space-time, which is 5-dimensional Annie de Sitter space across a Phi sphere. I'm certainly not going to really go into why there's reason to believe that. At the complete hand-waving level, I guess what I like is the qualitative argument that just says the string theory contains gravity, it contains quantum mechanics, so it's really a quantum gravity on a space-time that's asymptotically Annie de Sitter. You know that there are no good local observables in a theory of quantum gravity because of diffeomorphism invariance. What are good observables when you have a nice boundary like this are boundary correlations. Basically the answer to the questions, you throw something in from the boundary, you ask what makes it back out to the boundary. So it's at least reasonable that there should be a description of the physics of this theory in terms of some effective 4-dimensional theory that's just describing what you see on the boundary. And then you just say, well, what could that 4-dimensional theory be? It's got to respect the symmetries of the theory you start with. Well, this whole deformation was cooked up to end up with, on this side, the non-abelian gauge theory with the maximal amount of symmetry, the most supersymmetry you can have. And all of the rest, ordinary Poincaré symmetry, a large so-called R symmetry. Those symmetries perfectly match the symmetries you have on this other side. So if there's some 4-dimensional theory that should describe this string theory, and the symmetries have to match, you don't have any choice. The answer has to be n equals 4 super Yang nulls. Okay, given that proof, what's it good for? And the whole point of this gives you a way of recasting questions in the field theory in terms of dynamics in this dual gravitational description, and the limit in which things are easiest to understand on this side happens to be the same limits that I already introduced over there, large N and large lambda. Okay, I don't even think I'll say much of anything about the ADS-CRT dictionary. I just want to emphasize there is a very precise dictionary for how to translate questions on one side into questions on the other side. And if people want to talk about that, we could certainly do that. I do need to say a little bit about the space times I'm interested in, and it's not quite ADS5 cross S5 because I want to turn on a temperature to talk about thermal physics. That's changing things on this side. It's got to produce some change on the other side. The claim is turning on a temperature is the same thing as adding a black hole in ADS. Well, more technically, a black brain, something that has a flat planar horizon. And let me just sketch. So I'll introduce coordinates in my ADS space where I call my radial coordinate U. It'll have a boundary. You should think of ordinary Minkowski space as living on that boundary. Saying I have a black hole means I have a horizon. There it is, sitting at some location. I'll call it U sub H for horizon. And qualitatively, UV physics happens close to the boundary. IR physics happens deep in the interior of ADS space. Okay, so adding a black hole means we're really talking about ADS Schwarzschild. And should I write a metric? Maybe I won't even bother to write a metric. I will just say that there is a direct connection between the temperature and this radial position, and that connection is really just the same connection of Bekenstein and Hawking, that you can associate a temperature with a black hole horizon. Okay, and in terms of the setting, the one other thing I need to say before I get on to results is if I want to add heavy quarks which are in the fundamental representation to my field theory, and I'm going to want to do that because I want to ask questions that involve heavy quark dynamics, well, I'm changing my field theory. I'm just going to be adding fundamental representation degrees of freedom. If I do it in a way that where I'm really adding a hypermultiplet that's preserving half the supersymmetry, this has a nice description in terms of what you're doing on the other side, which is you're adding open strings. Really goes back to the earliest days of string theory, where you can think of the endpoint of an open string like a dynamical quark. But the way you can add open strings in this description, open strings have to have endpoints which live in sensible places. And in this case, it has to be ending on a D7 brain. That is simply a buzzword for saying that there are some, well, A D7 brain is an eight-dimensional space-time manifold, because that's the way Joe unfortunately decided to count. And it's that those eight dimensions are filling part of the five-dimensional Annie de Sitter space, and they're wrapping three of the five dimensions of the S5 that are basically going to play no role in anything I say today. If I wanted to add massless quarks, this D7 brain would fill all of Annie de Sitter space. If I want to add heavy quarks, then that D7 brain fills all of Annie de Sitter space down to some minimal position that I'll call U sub M. And the point is there's a direct translation between the minimal radial position of that D7 brain and the mass of the heavy quarks I'm adding. Yeah?
So you wrote these three equations, and then you know the first is convolutional, so in some sense true. Mm-hmm. About the other two, and the conjectures or...
Well, the fact that turning on a temperature corresponds to... I think it's fair to say it's just an essentially immediate correlator to the first one. If you buy the first one, you have no choice here. Yeah. And the second one here, I don't know. I think, again, you basically have no choice. There are some subtleties here that, again, adding these degrees of freedom is changing the short distance behavior. You can understand that on both sides. It matches. In the large N limit, that's really not an issue, and let's just not get into that. All right. What I did want to emphasize is the point of this D7 brain is it's a place where open strings can end. So you can have open strings that have one endpoint stuck on the D7 brain and the other end hidden behind the horizon. That's going to tell us something about the dynamics of a single free quark in this thermal setting. Clearly, you can have other open strings that have both of their ends stuck to the D7 brain, and that would be relevant if you wanted to study physics of quarkonia, a quark and an antiquark. And I'm not going to talk about that just because I don't have time. At the level at which I'm going to be talking about things, no. And if you want to sort of ask about that privately, feel free. I mean, the fact that's connected to the fact that introducing heavy quarks here reduces the global symmetry, the R symmetry, and it matches perfectly. Absolutely. Correct. Okay, so let's talk about results, which are certainly selected results. Results about this maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so one of the first things that was done, and it was actually done so long ago, honestly, I'm not sure who to credit with it, is just calculating the thermodynamics that corresponds to this Annie de Sitter Schwarzschild solution. Sorry? Okay, I can never remember exactly who was on that. Right, and so again, if you just look at it as this ratio, it's 3/4. Obviously, remarkably close to this figure, and is it just fortuitous or does it have deep meaning? Who knows? It's one of the questions. Okay, so we could talk about how they do that calculation, but in light of time, I'm really not going to go into any of that and just focus on the results themselves. This is pure equilibrium. It's really the least interesting observable in any discussion of thermal physics. all right, in a beautiful piece of work, Sun, Policastro, and Starnetz calculated the shear viscosity. And if you look at presented as a ratio to the entropy density, you get this marvelously simple result of 1 over 4 pi. It's now understood that this is the same result in a whole variety of theories which have dual gravitational descriptions. It's prompted lots of discussion about whether this could be, in some sense, a universal lower bound. I'll just put it up there as a result. It's closely related to diffusion constants. In this theory, you can talk about the diffusion of R charge, just the way you talk about the diffusion of any conserved global quantum number. And the same folks show that that has a very simple form. I want to put several more things up here. One of them I can only do by sketching result is something I was involved in. Instead of just looking at things that are single numbers, which is what these transport coefficients are, another nice question is to imagine you turn on electromagnetism with a weak coupling, just the way it is in the real world. And then you ask, how much does this thermal plasma glow? What is the spectrum of photons that it emits? Right? An approximation where you're neglecting rescattering of the photon. So in that treatment, calculating photon emission comes down to just calculating an electromagnetic current-current correlator. Its zero frequency limit is directly related to that diffusion constant, but now you want it for all light-like four momentum.
The
current
here is just one of the R
currents. Exactly. So I'm just picking a U1 subgroup of the R symmetry group to gauge and say that that's electromagnetism. Okay, I could show you, you know, the quantitative answer, but to get across qualitative things, I can just sketch it here. So I'm actually going to sketch the number of photons emitted per unit frequency weighted by a factor of frequency or energy. So the energy-weighted photon emission spectrum. First of all, it dies exponentially at large frequencies with the Boltzmann suppression. It has to. Right? You have very small probability of emitting photons whose energy is very large compared to the temperature. And yeah, that's about right. So there's a peak for photon energies, which is a few times the temperature, which is the only relevant scale in the problem. One nice thing you can do is say, how does that compare to the same question in the same theory, but when it's weakly coupled instead of being strongly coupled? The weak coupling calculation is more difficult than the strong coupling calculation. But basically, there's a weak coupling curve.
The weak coupling thing increases linearly, and the other one has a quartic
curve. My sketch is not perfect. So both of these curves increase start as k squared. If it wasn't for that factor of k, they'd increase linearly, and the slope is, in fact, the electrical conductivity. And the conductivity of the weakly coupled theory is much larger than the conductivity of the strongly coupled theory because particles have a much longer mean free path. And in particular, that means then you actually get more photons out in the weakly coupled theory in some range of frequencies at the low end. But the important thing, which I hope is obvious here, is that for energies that are, you know, comparable to the temperature, from one times the temperature to several times the temperature, it's exactly the other way around. And this is great news for efforts to separate photons that come from the quark gluon plasma phase of a heavy ion collision from boring photons, which come from things like Pinot decays that completely overwhelm you on the soft end of things. So what's experimentally relevant is, in fact, just this energy range in the middle there. Yeah? Sorry, guys.
Just for comparison, what would a black body spectrum,
I mean, it'll of course have the same cutoff at the high end. The low end, I think, just keeps, it's sort of a sick limit, but it just keeps climbing up. Yeah. Okay.
Because fireball is expanding, which have different weights for different times, we can all observe photons which are more shifted to the
Even harder. Even harder than what I wrote.
Because there are always, in order to observe soft ones, there are always later stages which have much, much larger volume of that soft emulsion, and therefore the subtle points of the
thing. Right, but now the.
What is the axis there? T in units of what?
That was photon energy over T.
Okay.
K over T. Right. Now there's a high momentum tail here that comes from basically ordinary perturbative hard scattering processes, which gives you some power law contribution that's always going to dominate at sufficiently hard photon energies. But that's right.
What did you say?
It's just this some intermediate range.
I'm saying the experiment doesn't measure a fixed temperature. Experiments measure fireball, which has variable temperature from high to low. And there is much more volume of space and time of low. So this low momentum is on the.
So this would be also folded by collecting. Some collective velocity is also.
That's right. So everything you get out of the experiment is some complicated convolution of. Okay.
Now, 1 second.
Yeah.
What is the experimental? So you're saying the photo emission is much higher by a big factor around 6 days.
Well, I mean, a factor, that, you know, factor of five or so. I think we're waiting for better results.
There are measurements of photons, but there is huge background from ideals, and in principle, there are different peaks of the subjective. The best way to measure, by the way, photons is to measure plus or minus the smaller layer.
Very helpful. Very.
Because 1 by 0...
Because they can measure, separate it better.
It's not done, okay? The answer, short answer is not yet done.
So these are 3 MeV photons? 300?
Well, I mean, first of all, as Edward said, I mean, it's getting convoluted from the highest temperature on down.
This is roughly 3 MeV, and that would be like 2 MeV. Several MeV photons will come from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you can talk about photon emission, talking about dileptron emission isn't much harder, except now you have to calculate that correlator for time-like four momentum instead of null four momentum. In fact, this one you can do analytically, and this one requires some trivial numerics. I'm not going to show any pictures here. I just want to put up a simple conclusion. What you find is that basically the result shows negligible effects due to the medium. If the invariant mass of the pair squared is above 2 pi t squared. So If you want to look at softer pairs, then it's a more complicated story. I just wanted to say for sufficiently hard dileptone pairs, you find that the result is indistinguishable from the result that you'd have in the weak coupling limit, and it basically just doesn't care about the medium. So, about lambda, right. So in one sense, that's good news, because at least there's one question where you have less theoretical uncertainty, and it's now a purely experimental problem of how well can you measure them. Well, space-like I haven't shown you at all. Light-like and type-like. Why is it so different? I mean, in hand-waving terms, right, if you ask questions about this correlator at light-like momenta and you're in a relativistic plasma, you're asking questions about emission of a photon which can stay, which can be coherent with excitations in the plasma over a long period of time. This is sort of a weak coupling description, but I think it still clearly gets some of the physics right. You ask questions deep in the time-like region, and you don't have this simple, you know, correspondence. In ultra-relativistic plasma, you've got lots of things running around at the speed of light, so it's easy for them to maintain phase coherence for a significant time. So the physics it probes can be different. Okay, moving right along. I talked about screening lengths from real QCD and lattice simulations. A natural question is, what do we know about screening lengths in this supersymmetric theory? And that's something where the actual sort of basic analysis that was needed was done quite a while ago by Brouwer, Tan, and building on previous work, but they didn't phrase it in terms of screening lengths. They didn't talk about this physics at all. But if you recast what's known, you find nice simple results for screening lengths in a variety of symmetry channels. And again, I'm just showing you two of the channels, the one that gives you the longest screening length and the one that corresponds to the Debye length. What those symmetry channels really are the same symmetry channels that...
I should compare these with 1/3 and 1/6.
Yes. By about a factor of 2. Now, as I said, you can really look at a whole bunch of different symmetry channels, and I was going to say this later, but I might as well just say it right now. If you look at ratios of screening lengths in one symmetry channel compared to another, you find those ratios agree quite well. In several cases, they agree clearly fortuitously well. The worst case, 30% off. If you look at their absolute values, there's basically just under a factor of 2 discrepancy. Right? These are different theories. There's no reason they should agree. I think it's pretty good. They only differ by a factor of 2. In particular, they have nice finite limits as lambda goes to infinity.
But it's computed, and C is pretty good to 3, then. It's computed, and I mean, if you say it gives a factor of 2.
No, that's independent of 2.
Yeah. Those were, you know, 3-color results over on the left, but these are results for the larger. No.
There was this Korean papers from early times when we did like on the CMA final temperature, and every time they cut the wires screened like 5G or something, 5G off.
Well, so they were talking about some notion of static potentials. They had R dependence. They also had a factor of square root lambda in there.
Square root of lambda in front of screening potential, but what in the
we should talk about this separately. There was a variety of papers which didn't really have the right long distance behavior. Okay. How are we doing? Who knows? Right, and that's something to pay attention to, because if you ask different questions, you shouldn't be surprised to get answers which do depend on lambda. And then if you're going to try and compare to the real world, you'll have to address this question that we talked about earlier, what value do you plug in? So one interesting question is to think about heavy quarks. It's relevant because experimentally you can attempt to extract production of heavy quarks, you can tag, you can do flavor tagging of jets and try and study jets that come from heavy quarks and see how they compare to those coming from light quarks. So I'm just going to say, let's ask questions about it. The first thing you can say is simply, if you've got this heavy quark moving through a plasma, it's just like a bullet moving through air or water, there's friction. It should lose energy. How fast does it lose energy? This is something that you can calculate in a really fun way because it's just doing classical mechanics of the string that I drew over here. So it's just like doing almost freshman physics, a little variational principle, find the right ansatz, find a solution that describes this quark moving at a velocity. And Edward drew the resulting solution yesterday. It looks just like sort of having a long tail stretching behind this moving quark that's moving with some velocity. Right. If you want to say quantitatively, what do you learn? Well, you learn that the energy loss per unit distance traveled, which is the same thing as momentum loss per unit time, is proportional to the momentum, a simple proportionality factor, which depends on square root lambda divided by the mass of the quark. Note that this is velocity independent. That's kind of weird. You think about normal materials, you think about shooting a bullet through, sure it's going to lose energy, but if you crank up the momentum of that bullet sufficiently far, you expect it, well, let me say it a little differently, right? This result, dp dt proportional to t, says that there's a fixed length over which that projectile loses, say, half its momentum, independent of the momentum it starts with. Normal materials, you don't expect that. If they're sufficiently hard, you expect them to basically just blast through the medium without even feeling it, and therefore the distance they'd have to travel to lose a fixed fraction of the momentum, you expect to get larger and larger. Now, this calculation is the right answer for a very precise question, which was, pick a velocity, any velocity you want that is less than one, maybe arbitrarily close to one, but less than one, and then send lambda to infinity. There's every reason to expect that there'll be non-uniformities if you did it the other way around. In other words, this result probably has a domain of validity, which is the associated gamma factor can be large compared to one. That's perfectly fine, but probably needs to be small compared to lambda to some power.
All right, this is what we call collisional energy loss. Is that right?
No. Well, first, yeah, there's no good way of answering that question, right? This is energy loss in a strongly coupled N equals 4 plasma. I don't know how to phrase that question in terms of expectation values of gauge invariant operators that would let me answer it in an unambiguous way.
So you don't even have an intuition of which
which process is dominating this energy loss?
All of our intuition is basically perturbative. It's based on weak coupling.
We can only ask where this energy comes from, and that is the next thing.
So you compute this in the ABS, and you say it's also something you see experimentally?
I haven't said much about that,
okay.
But let me just sort of give you the capsule answer without really justifying it. It is argued that what's seen experimentally is energy loss that is significantly larger than simple perturbative estimates would lead you to expect. And that's exactly at least the direction that this is going. To go much beyond that, we've got to return to the question of what's the right lambda to plug in. And that's a mess.
Processes in VLQCD are both collisional and radiative.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
So there's 1 over m here. That's the mass of the fork.
Yes.
This looks like a non-relativistic. Can you really take gamma?
Well, so if you say what really comes out of the calculation, what really comes out of the calculation is this result, which I just rewrote as P over M.
Because the calculation doesn't have anything like that. There's only heat.
Right. Okay, let me just mention a couple other things and try and wrap up. In a very pretty analysis, Steve Gubser looked at this physics and said, what can you say about fluctuations in the momentum of this projectile moving through the plasma? This result is basically giving you the change in the mean energy or momentum, but, you know, it's a thermal system, there's fluctuations, there's got to be fluctuations around those means. If you imagine some quark moving in a direction I'll call the z direction, you can distinguish mean square changes in the mean square transverse momentum from changes in the mean square fluctuation in the longitudinal momentum. And in a pretty calculation, which has a number of sort of conceptual beautiful points. Excuse me, I definitely should have mentioned Derek. I should have said done by not just Steve Gubser, but Steve Gubser and Jorge Casalderi Solana and Derek Tini. And their results nicely agree. What's interesting here is you get a result, scales like square root lambda, no surprise since you saw it there. But now you see a result which scales like the Lorentz boost factor, square root of gamma for the transverse fluctuations, an additional factor of gamma for the longitudinal fluctuations. Maybe you should be able to go from that to some answer to Emil's question about how should you think about the dynamics underlying it, but I am not at all clear on that. Sorry? Yes, that's what I meant. Right, so you start with some projectile moving in some direction I'm going to call the z direction. So initially it has zero transverse momentum. It goes through the medium, it gets, again, sort of switching to weak coupling hand waving description, it gets kicks from collisions in the medium, and its transverse momentum executes some sort of random walk. And this is just that random walk behavior, linear growth in the square of the transverse momentum with time. All right, but the striking thing is how these fluctuations get larger and larger as you go to harder and harder projectiles. Okay, and also fun, and relatively recent, is asking, if we have this particle losing energy to the medium, where does that energy go? A nice way of asking that is to simply say, let's make a picture of the energy density or the momentum density or other components of the stress energy tensor in this non-equilibrium state in which I've got this quark moving through the plasma. And Edward showed an early picture of my student Paul Chesler and I a while ago, and if people are patient, I'll show some more recent pictures. One thing I want to put on the board is not just trying to sketch a picture, but what do you do with that picture other than admire it? Well, you should do that. It's a very pretty picture. But you can actually see a lot of physics in that picture. And a lot of the physics that you see, you can understand using very simple freshman physics ideas, which are basically linearized hydrodynamics. And you can go beyond that. Linearized hydrodynamics is the correct effective theory to describe fluctuations, relaxation in the system on sufficiently large time and distance scales. But it's not a good description at sufficiently short distance scales. Well, what's long and what's short? Until you have a more complete calculation, you never really know. One nice thing you can do with this calculation of wakes is to compare it quantitatively with the prediction of linearized hydrodynamics and really say, what's the shortest distance at which that hydrodynamic description is valid? This is, I think, rather relevant to real heavy ion physics because all of the phenomenological modeling, almost, uses hydrodynamics with initial conditions which have pretty large gradients where you could wonder whether are you really in the hydrodynamic regime? How large are higher derivative corrections that you're completely ignoring?
Up to 2 years ago, 99% of people calculating jet bridge are calculating gluon constant. And you are saying you guys do not radiate gluons, you radiate sound. They were blocking. Still like a year ago.
And sound, maybe.
I said, what is sound? Not in the ground.
Okay, indeed. And so, you know, it's a nice change in the community. So in this theory, the temperature is fundamentally the only length scale. If you say, what is the beginning of the hydrodynamic regime, the answer has to be some pure number divided by temperature, because there's nothing else it could have been. But it could have been 10 over T, could have been 100 over T. And at least in this study, it turns out that it's darn close to 1 over T. They are technically different questions. One is purely static equilibrium, the other is dynamics. Is it surprising that they end up being similar? Maybe not. I mean, honestly, I don't know. Okay, in terms of just giving... The screen lengths are significantly shorter. Excuse me. Yeah, somehow I really could, but nevertheless, I could not possibly have believed this if this was 10 times smaller. I don't know. It just wouldn't make any sense at all. The screening length being smaller than 1 over T, maybe that seems puzzling at first because T's...
You totally expect this to be bigger than the screening length.
Right. And all I wanted to say here is, you know, in a sphere whose radius is 1 over T, we still have order n squared charges inside the sphere. There's lots and lots of particles inside this distance. Okay, in terms of some you know, quick run through of what I think are interesting selected results. That's what I wanted to show. I can show you some pictures if you want. In terms of similarity to QCD, oh, I guess I should end up just say one word about that. I already talked about part of it, what we know from screening lengths. Clearly, we don't have any good answer for saying how good a model is strongly coupled N equals 4 plasma for understanding strongly coupled QCD, because we're looking at N equals 4 because QCD is too hard. But there are basically two things you can do. You can look at specific equilibrium questions where we can study them when both theories are strongly coupled. And what I think is interesting is at least that list of quantities is now longer than the pressure. It's the pressure plus a handful of screening lengths. And it works generally to at least a factor of 2. That's not bad. That's just looking at equilibrium questions. The only other thing you can do is to look at more interesting non-equilibrium dynamical questions, but when both theories are weakly coupled instead of being strongly coupled. That's changing the question again. But if weakly coupled N equals 4 plasma is not a good model for weakly coupled QCD, I'll at least have trouble believing that strongly coupled N equals 4 could be a good model for strongly coupled QCD. So in that sense, I think the weak coupling comparison is an interesting sort of necessary condition.
Sorry, earlier you made the point that you didn't think
In terms of short distance physics, yes. Now I want to make a, when I said weak coupling, I mean something different. Now let me still think about thermal physics, the same sort of questions I've been talking about here. But imagine hypothetically that we could study these things at asymptotically high temperature in QCD so that it's weakly coupled on the scale of the temperature. And let me compare that to weakly coupled N equals 4. And asking that question brings up one important point, which is how do you make the comparison? Saying you have weakly coupled QCD means that I've got some measure of the interaction strength, the Etouffe coupling, which I'm now assuming is small compared to 1, but it's non-zero. I've got some of Etouffe coupling in super Yang mills. The most naive thing to do is to say, does the theory at some given small numerical value of Etouffe coupling when it's QCD look the same as super Yang mills at the same small value of the Etouffe coupling?
So that's right.
This is a horrible thing to do. If you do that comparison, you'll find they look very different, and it's easy to understand why. N equals 4 has a lot more degrees of freedom, therefore you have a lot faster rate of collisions. They look very different if you compare this way. However, sensible comparisons are to cook things up so that physical scales that are relevant to the physics you're interested in coincide in the two theories, and a natural thing to compare is the Debye scale. And if you compare things with that adjustment for a variety of things, that includes the photoemission spectrum, it includes the shear viscosity, it includes the energy loss rate of heavy quarks, I'm not saying they agree perfectly, but they agree really quite well. For the photoemission spectrum, it's almost astonishingly well.
Yeah, but that's a factor of 4 or something.
This is true. And so if you say, what does this condition imply for the lambdas? It's rescaling lambdas by a factor of 4 to 6. It's a significant factor. This is saying that
the
yeah, it's so it's It's making, no, hang on a second. Hang on, it's a little around. Right. So it's decreasing the value of lambda that you're saying you ought to be plugging into some formula for superangles. And again, whether it's 4 or 6, it's just in that ballpark.
It's more or less the same thing as both things that you increase number of colors, but increase G, which is the product.
It's, I mean, the details are different, but the spirit is very much the same. Absolutely. Don't have anything to compare to. Other than, well, don't have anything to compare to because here there was no lambda dependence. Which was, of course, beautiful because that agreed with no temperature dependence. Okay, that's all I have to say. If there's any questions, any discussion, that's what we're supposed to promote. But if people want to start that while I actually show you some pictures, that'd be fine too.
So does that mean if we have a value of lambda QCD, we're also looking and also have super young males at about 3?
Three, four, five. That's for small lambda. And so you really don't know that this is something you should trust at larger values. That's absolutely correct.
But we invert in the logic. We're not looking at Lagrangian and saying, will it work? Will it be strong coupling or weak coupling, etc.? We want to model strong coupling behavior of a system which is already strong coupling. We are not in the middle between two regimes. We are in one regime. Hyper-beautiful works, right? We yourself show that there are 5% corrections to the ideal height.
Well, that's the right question.
Yeah. If it is decoupling, there is nothing like hyper. People accept it quite extensively.
Yeah, now of course one of the things we don't know is what is the source of the largest differences between N equals 4 plasmas at strong coupling and QCD plasmas. We've changed the constituents of the plasma. But we're also, in all these strong coupling results, comparing at lambda equals infinity. Will we get much better agreement still using N equals 4 super Yang mills, but if we could just calculate results for, you know, lambda of 20, 30, 40, or is it really sensitivity to the constituents of the plasma?
Well, it's strong. In the strong coupling regime, right, the only thing you're comparing them is the thermal.
Except for equilibrium quantities. Yes.
You can compare it to QCD, but you can certainly do the same calculation for the same observable in different holographic fields.
Precisely.
And there you see that for most observables, you can have only one change in your result.
Well,
one is one, and one is two. It's never 100, but it's another one change. So what entitles...
And the discrepancies with QCD and basically everything I've shown you where we have any knowledge are also order one. Now, most of the things I've talked about have not yet been calculated in more complicated theories with gravitational duals. I mean, a variety of things have, but mostly equilibrium things so far.
Photon emission has been calculated.
Photon emission is one example.
The transfer coefficient.
Yeah, I mean, the rough features of the curves look similar, but, you know, for example, like where the PET is, etc., can change.
That's the real photo emission curve that I just had on the sketched on the board earlier. It's not, well, it's not dramatically different from what I sketched. Okay, everyone happy? But when I've seen all this. Here is a picture of the energy density on the left and the momentum density or energy flux on the right for a quark that's moving at 3/4 of the speed of light, you know, up and to the right. So this is a picture of excess energy density localized on a Mach cone at exactly the angle that you'd predict from freshman physics, just like Cherenkov radiation. Of course, it's not a discontinuity. And you only ever got misled into thinking that shock waves are discontinuities from discussions of the physics that completely mangled all the short distance physics, physics on the scale of mean free paths. So, I mean, here you have a treatment that's
taking the length from this picture from the size of the creature.
You mean in when I talked about the comparison to hydro? Not directly from this picture, but from something I'll show you in just a second. Yeah, at the
No.
If you do hydro with the correct values of viscosities, that's still hydro. You will get the same. Right. So I mean, you notice here that the width of this. This region, it broadens as you go away from it, and that's basically just a reflection of the non-zero value of the shear viscosity.
For classical shocks, the shock waves, the chapter stops doesn't work well in the shock region.
Because physics on the scale of a mean free path becomes relevant. Yeah. Okay, I did want to emphasize, here we have a picture of energy flux. And you need to think about that a little bit. Here you have this nice Mach cone. You think it's sort of sweeping through you, and therefore you perhaps naively think, isn't the energy flux going to be also localized here? No. I mean, you do see a little something going on, but there's this big tail behind it, which is basically diffusion physics. This is a nice visual demonstration that when you just look at linearized hydrodynamics, you find that longitudinal and transverse fluctuations behave differently. Longitudinal fluctuations are sound waves, and that's really what you see in this picture. Transverse fluctuations relax diffusively, and that's exactly what this tail is here. Its width is growing like the square root of the distance or the time from the distance between the quark and where you're looking. In terms of actual experimental predictions for RIC, this is a little bit more complicated. At least, you know, what you're really looking at is particles being produced. That would seem to be most sensitive to the actual flux of energy in the plasma, which is then going through this reprocessing of hadronization and all that. Well, most of the energy flux is not in the Mach cone.
Is that flux to which direction or various directions?
Well, there are little arrows, if you can see them here. In this diffusive tail, all the arrows are pointing toward the quark. And some strange things have appeared in certain papers in the literature about that. Because, you know, what's going on here? Is this a negative flux of momentum away from the quark? Right? All that is the physics of a boat moving through water. Right? If you start with water that's completely still and you run a boat across it, you'll have water that's moving in the direction of the boat right behind it. That's all this is. This happens to be subsonic, 1/4 of the speed of light. It's much more boring. There's, again, this diffusion tail behind the quark. There's no Mach cone, of course. There's a buildup of energy, a density in front of the quark, a deficit behind. Again, it's just like a boat moving across a still lake slowly.
Okay. In real fluids, energy loss, of course, depends very much if you are below or above the speed of sound.
In real fluids, typically with projectiles like airplanes that are very large compared to the mean free paths. So, for example, in an airplane, you know, the nose sets off a shockwave. The presence of that shockwave then changes the flow around following parts of the plane. Here we really have an idealized point-like projectile, structureless. So that physics really doesn't come into play.
But the way it comes doesn't depend on details and sizes.
Right.
So yes, there is a principal difference between something.
Oh, it's pure equilibrium thermodynamics. It's the derivative. The speed of sound squared is the derivative of dp d rho. Derivative of pressure with respect to energy density. Yeah, I mean you convert that, but in it, for any. And in fact. And in fact, everything cancels out except the dimension of space. Right. This is a scale invariant fluid. In any scale invariant fluid, the speed of sound squared is, well, 1/3 in three dimensions. Okay. I won't say anything about transonic. I won't say anything about linearized hydro. That's just some freshman physics. I did just want to show you this before I quit. So. How do you compare this with linearized hydro? I mean, there's lots of things you can do. Here's one comparison that we found, and I should have emphasized, all these pictures were work of my student, Paul Chesler. You can look at the angular distribution of energy flux. And that's exactly what's plotted here. This is the energy flux multiplied by a factor of r squared, just so curves for different radii line up in a similar dynamic range, as a function of the polar angle. The solid curves are the ADS-CFT results for three different radii, 5 over pi t, 10 over pi t, 20. The symbols are doing linearized hydro with the correct description of the source, because this is a system in which you're feeding energy and momentum into it. So getting that source described correctly shouldn't be hard, but there's been some confusion about that. Anyway, all you're supposed to see here is it agrees pretty darn well, right? There are details that are different, right? There's a little discrepancy there. If you look closely, you will notice the discrepancy is largest at shortest distances. That's the red triangles in this curve here. And gets smaller at large distance. The largest distance is the green curve. But, I mean, how can you look at that and not say that linearized hydro is doing a pretty good job even down at the shortest distance, 5 over pi t, which was my 1.5 over t. This is the supersonic case, and that's where the differences are biggest. And that makes sense because these differences are really due to higher derivative corrections, which have been neglected in the linearized hydrodynamic treatment. And the derivatives are biggest when you have that Mach cone. If you look at the subsonic case, the agreement is, I don't know, stunningly good. Okay, I think I better stop.
Speaking from an experimental point of view, I want to remind you this thing. The Greek plasma lost several families C, and then there was this region around the C, which we call Greek space, and then there was the Roman phase. So each of them replicated out there. So after this wave is excited, so plasma takes like 5 families C, which you make in short time, but it is much larger than correlation line. And fiber happens. Then there is another 5 pm over C in Greek space where the speed of sound nearly bends. Mm-hmm. And that I will tell you in a moment what it will make. And then there is a Roman phase where speed of sound is a different way because it has different expression space. Mm-hmm. So what we observe is a flow of matter at the very end after all of it. So by the end of the plasma, we have this picture, and we have from the kind of really similar picture. Right? So you have this wake behind, which moves along, and there are these two cones which move in particular direction, right? What happens is that after that, there is significant time. So during this time, actually, wake is dissipating. This is diffusion, right? Omega is I eta k squared, and it starts dying.
Right.
And of course, the other one is also starting dying, that's how it, more or less.
It's a similar system, right?
Right. But still, what we see at the end is the direction where sound was going. And what is also very interesting that so speed of sound changes very much. If it would be exactly first order transition, the speed of sound would be zero, just in the next case. Which means the very goal...
It would be zero where? At the transition.
At the transition, but transition, if you think in terms of T, is a point. But this is wrong. In experiment, you have entropy density. Entropy density continues or changes. So temperature simply stays constant, but the system still expands.
But right? You're talking about zero frequency sound.
No.
No, it's any it changes, sound. But the phase conversion takes time. And if you have a lot of time, then you need to arrive at the zero velocity.
For short time.
But for short times, the system is not time for real.
Well, but it is a long time. If 5 PM is short time, then forget about Hyder and all this phenomenon for the beginning.
All right, talking about the time.
But this transition of the wave. The wave passes its narrow region, you know, this front passes through. The matter has no time to, you know, go through phase transition and this stuff like that. The speed of sound will be similar as in each, let's say, even if you have the phase transition, like in each of the phases.
Well, that remains to be seen.
I know, but
you're arguing this mixed phase lasts as long as
in Hydra, when we describe overall Hydra, elliptic Hydra, and this Hydra, we use Hydra, so we use the virtual state which has all these features. So it really means that the wave moves and then it stalls for a while and then we continue moving again. Yes. Which is kind of very interesting. Yes. That reminds about famous story of Ron Munchausen who had the trumpet and cold weather and then he took it home and all sound gets cold.
The only thing clear to me is the picture before and after. The picture and the transition is not clear.
But at the very least, it is certainly true. Everything I talked about is a small part of putting it into a complete description.
So at the end of the day, we see the peak. At the end of the day, we see the peak, and the peak corresponds to time average speed of sound.
You see the peak in what?
In angular distribution of energy correlated with the jet. And this angle is about 60 degrees.
Sorry, you see the speed of sound in the hadronic manner?
Yes, and then we see pions.
So this wake?
So the wake survives.
No, forget about the wake. I mean, they cone.
Mm-hmm.
The cone.
Now we have a transition, which I imagine is not understood or strongly first order.
Well, I mean, the equilibrium properties we understand, and Edward is describing the dynamics by simply taking that equation of state and plugging it into a hydrodynamic description.
It goes with one angle.
Which is first order.
Close to first order.
But it's not close to first order.
So it goes with one cone, then part of it stalls, and the other is
moving.
So in other words, the shape of the cone is changing, and at the end of the day, we have some direction.
Folder.
Which corresponds to Mach formula, in which instead of power square root of three, you plug time average speed of sound. Not speed of sound, but time average speed of sound, which is less than. So instead of 1/√3, it happened to be 1/3.
So in the hadronic medium, what is the speed of sound?
It's about square root of 0.2. Yes.
square root of 0.2 instead of it's where does that come from?
If you're talking about the speed of sound, not the speed of sound squared.
Speed of sound
squared.
Well, I said square root of 0.2. So if I draw a picture with, and that is, by the way, of the study of the lakers in some detail. So we have one curve, and then we have kind of strong growth, and then we have another constant, which is 0.2, and that I calculated like 30 years ago for resonance Gaussian.
But it goes to zero.
And those lattice calculations?
Yes, there are lattice, especially on this side, there are lattice calculations up to here very well. This is DC, of course.
It goes to zero in zero.
Well, it's nearly zero, because it's for a solar.
At zero temperature, it goes
back. Zero, no?
Yes.
Well, because fine mass is here.
Yes.
There is some very small region here. So, but result is, kind of, not only we have the largest temperature, but the smallest temperature. And by the way, the largest fireball we make, the lower is the lower temperature. The largest is the largest, and the lowest is the lowest. Because the system is larger, and it keeps, right? Remember, the lowest temperature of Big Bang is 3 degrees, right? So the region of S well T is not relevant. We only have to go to temperature about 100 degrees, and the system is up. There is, so to say, dt over c of t is a distance which sound travels. Okay? And the angle which you calculate is very close to hydro-calculated cone at the end, and this is close to what is observed.
Okay. So somehow this whole thing is observed right. So you have this is an angle relative
once again
beam of the radiated energy.
Okay, so this is a transverse picture.
One bar chart that you see and ask about the distribution of particles in the opposite hemisphere.
So you observe one jet with light speed. And then you look at here, and normally, if there is no medium, you have the opinion jet exactly back to back. Because there's plane, right?
Right. But now you have this angle.
And now you observe that there is
60
degrees. If you plot, by the way, in polar coordinate, so normally you expect something like this. Some picture like this, a jet, then nothing, and then another jet, something like this. In DP collision, if you plot it versus angle. While in this, you see a picture like this, where this angle is about 60 degrees. When the maximum like this. And it's nearly all the angles happen to be 60 degrees, kind of 20, you know. It really looks like instead of jet to jet, you have jet to two. With equal, which is just square numbers. So somehow it survives. Yes? It's easy to say it will die.
Where does the 0.75 for C come from, or what kind of velocity you assume for the jet? You know, because if you
the velocity is C, of course. Jet is several GeV jet, so right. It's of course velocity is C.
I mean, in my calculations, 0.75
is example.
Came out of thin air, we picked it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't describe any of the issues of doing this basically, you know, hologram transform, if you want to call it numerically, but, you know, things get harder if you get very, very close to C. So we just picked 3/4 as an interesting supersonic value.
Yeah, you have one square root of 3, so it's 0.5.
Right.
Something like this. If you, at LHC, we kind of wrote a small paper, actually, with one of the members. If you have 10 B quarks, which they claim they will have, you can have B quark, which is several GeV jet, and at the same time, velocity is not one. But for example, so when there is no hope to get subsonic jet, but you can still have velocity not equal 1, and you will see that if PT goes The direction of this angle goes in the direction opposite of Bremsstrahlung, because when velocity goes exactly sound velocity, the whole thing disappears. Yes.
No. Well, that's when the thing opens up to...
No, I don't remember exactly, but the whole idea is that you can do deep-wire jets with velocity different from one, like 0.8. And then you're supposed to see predictable change in angle, which, you know, you divide the same speed of sound, divide by 0.8, which is... so that maybe will be similar.
Can I make a suggestion that we break and return if people want to continue? I wouldn't be surprised if the cookies are gone. I'm warning the coordinators, you will face mutiny if you continue.